I hope I've landed on my feet this time.
Need a place to rent? Have a place for rent? AMS Rents Line can help. AMS Rents Line is an easy-to-operate, touch-tone, and web-based system that connects thousands of landlords with UBC students looking for off-campus housing. UBC students can search the ads for free or place a two-week posting for $5. To view current listings, visit www.amsrentsline.com.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
This is News 101, and the current time is 5:12 p.m. Prime Minister Stephen Harper, fresh off the G8 leaders meeting in Japan, where he focused on the environment, arrived at his home base in Calgary and wasted no time in attacking the opposition leader's green plan. Dressed in a Stetson and a checkered cowboy shirt, Harper told a crowd of Conservative Party faithfuls Sunday night at a Calgary Stampede barbecue that Liberal leader Stephan Dion's plan to shift taxes toward carbon-emitting industries and away from individuals would devastate the Canadian economy. Harper called the plan a wealth redistribution program disguised as an environmental policy. Dion's plan, called the Green Shift, would deliver $15 billion in broad-based income tax cuts to Canadians facing higher energy and goods prices as a result of new taxes on domestic industries that produce high carbon emissions. But Harper told the crowd of Stampeders that the program will stop the economic progress of the Canadian middle class and make the cost of living, quote, unbearable for fixed-income seniors and low-income seniors. Global carbon emissions were a major focus of the Group of Eight summit in Tokyo, Japan, that ended last week. World leaders, including Harper, endorsed the idea of having global carbon emissions by 2050. Attending his third Calgary Stampede as Prime Minister, Harper also repeated his party's pledge to deal with the, quote, escalating problem of violent youth crime when Parliament resumes in the fall. Recent Statistics Canada figures show that while overall youth crime is down significantly in the past 15 years, violent crime involving 12 to 17-year-olds has surged 30% since 1991.
An ex-serviceman is risking eviction from his building over the flying of the Canadian flag. Mark Murray, 53, refuses to take down the Canadian flag on his balcony in a subsidized housing unit in Cardinal, Ontario, even though the local housing authority is threatening to evict him. Murray served with the Royal Canadian Regiment and the Canadian Airborne Regiment in the 1970s and 1980s. He lives in the Seaway Apartments, which are operated by the Community Housing Authority and United Counties of Leeds and Grenville. He said Friday he was given the flag by his local branch of the Royal Canadian Legion last year, and he has flown it ever since. Now he has received more encouragement not to take down the flag and says he doesn't have the heart to take it down after the overwhelming support he has received from others. Last Thursday, an official from the Community Housing Department told him the flag had to come down or he would be sent an N5 letter, the first step in the process leading to eviction. He was told the flag violates a rule requiring all subsidized properties to have a uniform appearance. Murray says he was going to negotiate, but that now he sees the issue as having taken on new meaning to families and the Canadian troops.
And over to international news, we now go to Free Speech Radio News for a piece on the American terror list.
Arbitrary, bloated, inefficient, and unchecked. That's the way the American Civil Liberties Union describes the Transportation Security Administration's terrorist watch list. The list now tops 1 million names and continues to grow at an estimated 20,000 names per month. The names include college students, heads of state, even infants, and countless more unsuspecting citizens whose only link to terrorism is a name that just happened to be too similar to someone else's. Caroline Fredrickson is the director of the American Civil Liberties Union's Washington Legislative Office. Fredrickson says the list is simply illogical.
There is a very Byzantine and bureaucratic system where people can get on this list from any number of federal agencies that can, and they, you actually use this word, nominate them. It's a nomination you would not want to get. Nominate people to be on the list. There's no real rationale that we can perceive, or certainly no standard approach between the different agencies that can nominate people for the list. And there's really no way either to find out whether you're really on the list or if you think you're on the list to try and get off.
And there's now more than 1 million names that are on this TSA terrorist watch list. How many of these people are actually associated with terrorism in any way?
Well, it's really hard to say. We do know that there have been many mistakes. 2 years ago, CBS 60 Minutes did a story where they had gotten a copy of one of the watch lists. I think it was the no-fly list. And it was clear from that list that they had basically many, many errors that picked up Americans who'd never been associated with any type of activity. And through anecdotal evidence, many people coming forward. We have clients in a case that's coming out of the ACLU of Illinois, where people are being harassed, sometimes detained, sometimes humiliated, but certainly inconvenienced across the country, people who have no association with terrorism. Today, we did a press conference here in D.C. where I spoke, along with Jim Robinson, who's the former Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division of the Department of Justice under the Clinton administration, along with a gentleman named Akif Rahman, who is an American citizen who lives outside of Chicago, born in America, and has started his own computer firm and travels a lot. Well, both of them have had significant troubles flying. Jim Robinson actually has a top secret security clearance, which came from his work at the Department of Justice and has continued because of some of the legal work he's handling now. And Akif has had regular troubles. Well, he travels to many different countries for business, including having been handcuffed to a chair on one return from Canada, detained for hours and hours, separated from his family. His wife and children were also detained. I mean, this has gone on and on for him for many years.
Defenders of the program will surely say that it's better to be safe than sorry. Is it really better to be safe than sorry? What are the benefits?
Well, I think we can be safe and not sorry. It's a false choice. What we're suggesting is that the list needs to be cleaned up, that the list needs to be run properly. If it's a more streamlined list, if it's actually targeted at people who are planning on doing us wrong or doing us harm, we can actually have a higher success rate of stopping people before they commit an act that might put us in danger. If you have a bloated list, which includes many, many people who have no business being on that list, and we just end up harassing people and inconveniencing them, that does none of us any good. So all we're suggesting is that the list actually needs to have some key protections built in. Number one, what should be very commonsensical, I think, to your listeners is people shouldn't be put on the list unless there is a strict criteria. Why should somebody be put on a list? And the governments need to come up with that very fine set of criteria before somebody goes on this list. If somebody is on the list mistakenly, there needs to be a procedure for them to be taken off. Those are two key things that wouldn't stop us from being safe, would in fact enhance our safety, and we wouldn't have to be sorry.
Caroline Fredrickson is the director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office. The group is demanding the president issue an executive order requiring the list be reevaluated.
And it's time for another break, but when we come back, we'll hear international news again from Free Speech Radio News. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Vancouver Pride Society invites you to volunteer. This year at Pride, we're looking for parade marshals. If you want to help out and make a difference and get the best seat at the parade, join us. VancouverPride.ca for more info.
Backed by popular demand, the Vancouver Folk Music Festival returns with the 2008 Folk in the City series. Taking place at Vancouver's Yale Hotel, located on 1300 Granville Street, the Folk in the City series begins and ends the Vancouver Folk Fest. On Wednesday, July 17th, get a head start on Vancouver's Folk Festival with Marcus James and the Wassenry with the Blue Voodoo Duo. Then, on Monday, July 21st, catch the festival's last performance with T-Model Ford and guest Kenny Blue Boss Wayne. Tickets are available online at the festival's website, thefestival.bc.ca. See you at the Yale.
Go
GoGreenCellos.com and the Pemberton Festival now have a direct cello service all weekend long from Vancouver right to the festival gates. GoGreenCellos.com is your alternative to high fuel and parking costs, with return tickets just $70 when purchased before July 10th.
That's right, there are ways to go green without spending a lot of green.
Want to find out what going green really means? Want to find ways to save money and conserve resources like energy and water?
GoGreenCellos.com. You do the partying, we'll get you there.
On Sunday, August 17th, come celebrate Vancouver's Latin community at Trout Lake Park. From 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., Trout Lake Park will be vibrant with Latin colors, arts, culture, food, and spirit.
The morning starts off with a parade along Commercial Drive, an import market, and food pavilions surrounding an outdoor stage where artists from flamenco to Cuban rueda delight on stage in this free community expo, complete with a kids' activity area.
Being Latino is great, man. Latin pride.
See you at Trout Lake Park on August 17th.
Welcome back to News 101 in this summer. I'm Rita Farkas, coming to you live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight. In other international news, we'll hear once again from FSRN on women in politics in Lebanon.
Lebanon has created an image of being one of the most tolerant Arab countries when it comes to women. In comparison to other countries in the region, women in Lebanon play an active role in the private sector. Yet, although Lebanese women are more represented in the workforce than in neighboring Syria and Jordan, they are far less represented in politics. As FSRN's Simba Russo reports, women also face obstacles due to controversial nationality laws.
The most common way women have entered the political scene in Lebanon has been to fill a post left empty by the death of a male relative. Legislation continues to challenge the equality of women in Lebanese society. This includes discriminatory laws concerning the family, nationality, freedom of movement, and the right to work, all combining to hamper a woman's ability to participate independently in public life. On Saturday in Isla Mireze, the Collective for Research and Training on Development Action, CRTDA, announced the relaunching of a campaign to address these issues. Vera Hayek is the Gender Project Officer for CRTDA.
So now for this lobbying level, we will be targeting the parliamentarians and the parliamentarian blocs and government, hoping for them to know or even to give women's issues special interest and even women's right to nationality.
Organizers say one of the problems centers around nationalization and the highly politicized issue of Palestinians and Syrians married to Lebanese women. Some fear these marriages will shake up the sectarian demographics of the country. Rula Masri, founder of CRTDA's Right to Nationalize campaign, says the issue is not about how many women are married to Palestinians, Syrians, or other foreigners. She says this issue is one of human rights.
The research that we have issued, it indicates that only 1.6% of the women, around 1,000 women, of Lebanese women married to non-nationals, only 1.6% of the whole Lebanese women are married to Palestinians, and the 56% are married to Iraqis.
The nationality law was established in 1925, and a decree in 1994 granted nationalization of some children born to Lebanese mothers. Morocco amended the nationality law in 2005, Algeria and Egypt in 2007. However, Lebanon, Bahrain, and Syria have not amended their laws.
They will may probably go to university in Syria, but I have the problem that after university, they will not be able to serve the country in any of the governmental services.
Reem El-Jabi is a Syrian national married to a Tunisian. Her children were born in Syria and attend Syrian schools. According to Jabi, Syrian women feel as though they are second-class citizens in their own country.
Although 12% of the judge in Syria are women, which is a very large number, yet they're not allowed, no woman is allowed to become judge of the civil service law, of this civil status law.
Algeria has been the most successful in that women are able to amend the constitution as well as the law. Algerian women's advocate Huria Chaouch says one of the strategies they used was exposing the plight of women and families in Algeria who are subjected to marginalization on social and economic levels.
We worked on several strategies, like creating seminars with women's associations, advocacy work, lobbying. Most important was the will of the women who worked to demand that laws be changed.
In the period of political instability in Lebanon, following the assassination of former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri, has made it difficult for women to make progress in entering politics. But according to the CRTDA's Vera Hayek, Lebanese women will continue to press political leaders until their rights are granted. For Free Speech Radio News in Beirut, this is Simba Russo.
And thanks, as always, to FSRN for their piece. Right now it's 5:27 and time for this week's weather forecast. Here's Carrie Baptist.
Weather this week should be nice. We should be continuing to have sun with partly cloudy. Tonight, there should be a low of 13. Tomorrow, there should be a high UV index, so put on the sunscreen. And there should be sun with cloudy periods and a high of 24. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, same, mix of sun and cloud, high 22. Back to you, Rita.
And thanks for that, Carrie. That's our program for Monday, July 14th, 2008. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. And if you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Carrie Baptist produced this radio program. For more news, join us next Monday at 5 p.m. for the next edition of News 101. For the entire news team here at CITR, this is Rita Farkas thanking you for listening. Stay tuned for Career Fast Tracks, coming up next on 101.9 FM CITR.